Original pirate material. You're listening to the streets. Lock down your aerial. Has it come to
this? This is the A-Noise Daily Roundup. A-Noise is a web stream covering the protests around the Republican National Convention in New York City. I'm Kat Aaron with Rise Up Radio from the New York Indie Media Convergence Space. The streets of New York were wild Tuesday on a major day of direct action. At least 900 people were arrested for a total of 1,460 arrests since the protest began Friday. We speak with a protester about her experience with the arrest process and conditions in jail. And we hear from an organizer of the DNC to RNC march about how to get what you want when negotiating with police. But first, Christina Heatherton and Tariq Karula have a summary of today's events.
From Ground Zero to Sotheby's on the Upper East Side, New York erupted today in a series of spontaneous acts of civil disobedience. Following two historic days of jubilant demonstrations, protesters transformed the streets into zones of resistance throughout the city. Christina Heatherton and Tariq Karula have a summary of the day's events.
At 3 p.m., the War Resisters League began a peaceful funeral march honoring all those who have died in the war. The march began at Ground Zero and was supposed to end at Madison Square Garden. Half a block into the march, police corralled participants, arresting over 200. By 7 o'clock, the remaining marchers joined nearly 1,000 protesters converging just south of the convention center. There, protesters performed a massive die-in.
Earlier in the day, demonstrators congregated at Union Square, a park on the Lower East Side of town. By 5 p.m., reportedly 1,000 protesters were moving north towards the convention center, met by intense police resistance. Peaceful participants were corralled by police. When the order to disperse came, protesters enclosed in nets were unable to move. Dozens were arrested. Bill O'Reilly of Fox News has a habit of telling his guests to shut up who present anti-Bush, anti-war, or anti-corporate opinions. The favored catchphrase has come to symbolize a larger silencing of independent voices by the corporate media. Today, groups such as Code Pink and the Ronald Reagan Home for the Criminally Insane decided to organize a protest to give it back to the network. Demonstrators stood outside of the Fox News Network studios chanting, shut up for hours. Many reported being struck and tossed violently by police while handcuffed. Secret with Portland Indie Media spoke with Medea Benjamin of Code Pink.
Well, I'm here to say that Fox News is one of the corporate media that has done the worst job in telling the real situation post 9/11, and that thanks to corporate news and the misinforming of the American people, we're in the situation that we're in today. And I think if we are going to get our democracy back in any way, it's going to be by fighting to have a media that really has to tell the truth, or else their access to the public airways get yanked. But I was also a victim of the police right now, right here, as I was following a colleague who was being arrested and asking why she was being arrested. I got handcuffed, thrown against a paddy wagon, stuck inside, and taken where they questioned me about why I was here and what I was doing. So I think in addition to protesting what the media has been misinforming the public, we've also got to keep protesting against a government that is repressing our right to free speech.
Finally, the Woman and Man in Black bloc staged a protest at Sotheby's Auction House. Republicans had an exclusive celebration of Johnny Cash for the Tennessee delegates inside the famous auction house. The event was sponsored by the American Gas Association, a multinational corporation whose membership includes gas companies in Brazil, Korea, and France. Over 500 protesters convened in defense of the honor of the late singer, who they say, quote, sang for the poor, the imprisoned, and the oppressed.
And that's a summary of the events of Tuesday, August 31st in New York City. As an estimated 900 people were arrested in Tuesday's demonstrations, concern grew about the treatment of the protesters in jail. A-Noise spoke with Tiana Kennedy, who was released from jail Sunday after spending over 30 hours on lockdown.
This is Tariq Karula and Kat Aaron with the New York City Independent Media Center and the A-Noise Soundstream. We're speaking with Tiana Kennedy, who was arrested at Friday's critical mass bike ride, and she's going to give us an update and report back of the arrest process. Before that, I'd like to update folks with the latest from the National Lawyers Guild. I spoke with Reality Check, a working group for the A31 Coalition and media relations for the National Lawyers Guild. They've estimated between 500 and 1,000 arrests just today. Charges have ranged from misdemeanors to assault and felonies. Police have been processing arrests at Pier 57, a repurposed bus depot on Manhattan's west side. It's earned the name Lil Gitmo for Guantanamo Bay. The New York Civil Liberties Union and the National Lawyers Guild are calling for an investigation into the conditions at Pier 57. We've had reports of dangerous and possibly toxic conditions, and Tiana will tell us more. Reality Check is also reporting that the space is full and processing continues at White Street downtown. We've also had reports of intense police brutality, illegal arrests, and curtailment of constitutional rights today.
Tiana, thank you for joining us here. You were arrested Friday night at the critical mass demonstrations where hundreds of other people were arrested. Can you talk a little bit about what happened when you were arrested and what the process was like?
Sure. We were first penned in with innocent civilians and lawyers and press people. Some of the corporate press on bikes got out, whereas in the media press who didn't have bikes were still taken away. They then handcuffed everybody, separated, took all of our personal belongings. After a couple of hours of sitting around, they would ship us out on buses. I was arrested at 34th Street in Dyer. They used what seemed to be like cattle ranching techniques to divert us from the larger group and just corral us into a pre-planned pen, and at which point they spread a banner across the open end and trapped us inside.
And it was when you were in the pen that your belongings were confiscated and Polaroid pictures were taken of you?
Correct. No one ever read us our rights, told us what was going on, or gave us any information at all.
And how long were you in this pen?
I was probably there for about an hour and a half, maybe 2 hours. We were there at 9, I believe, and I didn't arrive at the little get until 11. So there was a lot of standing around and a lot of people were afraid, etc. But there wasn't much violence, and the police were actually, at that point, pretty docile.
So you were cordoned off into this pen, and then what happened?
I was led with a group of about 15 women into the back of an old paddy wagon from like 1930. It looked just like Cool Hand Luke or something, although the ventilation was plexiglassed over, so there was no ventilation. A lot of people were having a hard time breathing and were almost passing out. There were too many of us and we couldn't all sit down. Some people were sitting on each other's laps. Spirits were pretty high. Good women. And then they took us to the compound.
Were your hands cuffed at this point?
Our hands were cuffed the entire time, yes.
So plastic
behind
bracelets?
Behind our backs, yes. A couple of people got their hands out and were told that we would be charged with felonies if we were to do that again. So we kept our hands behind our backs. And then they tightened all of our cuffs after that. And a lot of people had bruises. I had bruises for a couple of days afterwards. Then we were brought to the bus depot and kept there inside with no air. Again, they kept the doors of the van locked.
So you were kept still in the van?
In the van, inside the depot, while they were trying to figure out what they were doing. There was a lot of ineptitude evidence that evening. We finally begged and pleaded, and they opened some doors, at which point the men who were arrested after us rolled up in this beautiful MTA air-conditioned bus and were laughing at us because we were all falling out of it, you know, passed out. We were led from the back of the bus to holding pens that looked like a dog kennel inside of some people say repurposed, but basically it was just they threw up some chain link and razor wire and, you know, put in some porta potties, and it looked very much like a dog kennel. The floors were completely covered in like 30 years of toxic sludge from, you know, pulling out engines and letting who knows what. We weren't too concerned because we thought it was a quick processing. They told us all along the way, you know, the cops were always telling us, oh, you'll be out in an hour, everything's fine, you know. But so after a couple of hours sitting in the first pen cage, everybody was calling them cages, we finally got processed and had to do some paperwork. Our arresting officers stayed with us the entire time we were there.
How big are these cages?
I would say maybe 15 by 15 or something like that. There's two rows of them. One is, you know, one is for people entering and one is for people exiting. And then there's a table in the middle where people process you. And on the back of your Polaroids that were attached to your personal belongings and then your paperwork, they had something called your pedigree. Basically, they were getting as much personal information as they could to profile people, you know, your job, your income, what you do.
And how were they finding out that information?
They asked people, and people that weren't informed by the National Lawyers Guild to say nothing thought that it was just part of the process and gave all of their information. And then we were, after a couple of hours in the first pen, we were moved to a second pen. By this point, it was, you know, 1 a.m. or so, and people were very tired. A lot of us had been working all day and had just wanted to go for a bike ride and didn't, you know, it wasn't a protest. That was one thing that the prisoners said over and over again. I wasn't here for a protest. I just wanted to go for a bike ride.
Kennedy went on to describe the protesters' night at Pier 57, where the protesters had no choice but to sleep on the oily floor. The cages where they were held were cold, and the detained women had no food and little water for the 12 hours they spent at the pier. At 10 on Saturday morning, they were taken to New York Central Booking.
We were moved around the basement of Central Booking. They chain-ganged us whenever they moved us around. Like, when we got out of the bus, there were about five people per chain, and we each had cuffs, and they moved us around that way, so that was very humiliating. They searched us. I was kind of delirious at this point, very, very tired. So, like, when they were asking me to, like, you know, shake out my bra, you know, I was like, what do you mean? kind of exposing myself, and everybody was laughing, and, you know, it was, like, really humiliating. It was really dumb. There were a lot of comments about the women, obviously, from the police. Yeah, one of the women that I was with had been told that she had childbearing hips by her arresting officer when she was trying to take off her bike chain. You know, just normal stuff for New York, although it wasn't appropriate. My arresting officer was a woman, so I kind of lucked out there, I think. And then we were brought upstairs after hours and hours again to another holding cell. These cells, I was told that they were used generally for those that are just coming and going from court, so they weren't meant as long-term holding, you know, stations. People did get food eventually. They got some sandwiches that were just, you know, peanut butter and or cheese and or moldy bologna sandwiches that were good for laying on because we didn't have any pillows, but they weren't so great for eating. I begged and begged and got an apple. At this point, it was there for, I don't know, 15 hours, and I got an apple. The wardens, they were pretty attentive, but we were peaceful, and they weren't angry, and I'm really, really concerned with the treatment that people are... I mean, the only thing that made that whole situation bearable was the kind of camaraderie in the cell and the professional demeanor of the cops, but that's obviously not the case this evening, and very, very worried about my friends that are arrested this evening. You know, we were there for over 30 hours. I did sleep on some benches. There were 16 to 47-year-old women there. The 17-year-olds were concerned. They didn't have a chance to call their parents. No one knew what was happening. No one ever knew why they were being held or what the charges were going to be. The police didn't know. I don't believe they weren't telling us because they weren't telling us. I believe they weren't telling us because they didn't know. Some of the police, the arresting officers, when filling out the paperwork, wrote, I don't know, for the reason for arrest. You know, so it was definitely just orders from above. It was pretty confusing for everybody. So we did call the National Lawyers Guild. We had payphones in the cells, and they were the only people that gave us any sort of guidance through the whole process.
And what were you ultimately charged with?
Nothing. Nothing at all. I think some people were charged with disorderly conduct, some people perhaps with parading without permit, which I think most people were pretty psyched about. If you're going to have a criminal record, I think parading without permit would be the one that I would choose. I was released with a DAT. It was explained to me that basically as long as I don't get in trouble in the next 6 months, that they're going to forget about it and I never have to think about it again, you know, which is what I'm sure the city would hope for us all to just wander away and forget about it, but I don't think that's going to happen.
And when were you ultimately released from Central Booking?
I was released at 1:30 a.m. on Sunday morning.
And what happened to your bike?
My bike is not my bike. It was a colleague's bike who is currently going through the same thing I was going through then. He's in jail right now. I had locked it up at 35th Street, and I guess the police came back and cleaned out the area. Most people were identified with their belongings and their bike, and most people were able to reclaim their bike, but ours is missing right now.
Thank you, Tiana. Thank you for joining us. And it sounds like a really harrowing process.
It was, yeah, the worst part, I believe, was just lying in the cold and the sludge and not being able to get ever clean. I took a couple of showers before I came off, and I had a hard time breathing, and I think I heard that some people were getting chemical burns from it. And if anybody is listening, if anybody knows anyone that's planning on getting arrested, I really highly recommend getting a sample of the floor to be used as evidence later.
We spoke with Tiana Kennedy. She was arrested on Friday night around 10 p.m. and spent over 30 hours being processed and arrested, and described her harrowing experience for us. And we've heard that the area that Tiana was taken to, Pier 57, is currently full, and people are being processed somewhere else, and we don't know what the conditions are like there.
The Republican and Democratic National Conventions were separated by 28 days and 258 miles. DNC to RNC, a coalition united in pursuit of direct democracy, decided to bridge the political and the physical distance between the two conventions.
We are in the studio speaking with community activist Simon Sanchez from Austin, Texas, who was a part of the DNC to RNC march.
How's it going?
I'm doing good. Welcome to A Noise. I'm glad you're here with us.
Glad to be here.
Can you talk a little bit about the march and what you were hoping to highlight with the DNC to RNC march?
Well, obviously, the march was in opposition to both parties, but rather than being an anti-march, it was more of a for-march, for community, for peace, but peace with justice and dignity. We weren't necessarily saying don't vote, but rather don't just vote. Get out and organize in your communities, reach out to communities of color, reach out to community gardens, reach out to youth advocacy programs and things like that. And that was one of the integral components of the march, was reaching out to communities along the way and doing what we called deployments. So that was the real cause to me, for me, like personally, I can't speak for the entire march, but was drawing the connections not just between the occupation in Iraq and Afghanistan, but the occupation of countries throughout the global south through different forms of politics and economics, but then even more so the occupation of communities of color here in our own country through gentrification and police brutality and things of that nature that we're seeing more and more and more, especially here in New York. The march going from the DNC to the RNC raised more scrutiny than I think a lot of the actions that are going on here. For example, Seeds of Peace, the kitchen that was cooking for the march, was raided by the FBI, Secret Service, and six different agencies in Boston as soon as they drove into the city. And they took their propane tanks, which was going to be used to cook our food. Of course, they attack our food, you know. That's their strategy everywhere in the world. Why not here in the United States? And then individuals along the march that were participating had home visits from the FBI. And in particular, like, the sweetest, like, most awesome, like, medic kid, you know, that I met. Like, he's just the sweet kid. And, of course, the FBI went and, like, harassed his mother and told her that her son was a terrorist and stuff like that. So those are the types of things that we just experienced right off the bat. When I arrived on the scene, I arrived to mainly do video work, but immediately I was recruited to do police liaisoning because the police presence was getting kind of whack. So in the state of Massachusetts, heading into Connecticut, there's this town called Walpole, Massachusetts. And if you don't know much about Walpole, Massachusetts, the thing about this town is it's the South in Massachusetts. Lots of Confederate flags and lots of bikers and lots of Nazis. And we noticed immediately as soon as we got into town that the bikers and, like, the shaved heads were all, like, hanging out with the cops and, like, pointing and laughing at us and stuff like that. And we went and did an action at a prison there in Walpole. It's probably one of the most serious prisons in the country. And as soon as we got there, they, like, turn off the video cameras, and that's where, like, my police negotiating began. I was like, there's no way in hell we're going to turn off our cameras and let you slam us. We won't film the facilities, and we'll just do our street theater in the street and film the street theater. But, you know, we have a legal right to film for our legal protection, sorry. And that basically started the police liaisoning along the march.
Yeah, I want to get back to this issue of police negotiation, but can you, how many people were on the march? And for people who don't know about it, you were literally walking from Boston to New York?
That's right. And there were about 80 people consistently on the march. Some people left and came back. Some people left and didn't come back, and other people joined. We had about a steady 80 people on the march the whole way. We stayed in churches and school buildings. We stayed in parks. Oftentimes, we got housing the day that the march was coming into a community, and people just reached out. And one of the things about the march, I think that was, like, the most powerful thing, is that most of the communities we were coming through were, like, middle-class or upper-middle-class communities that were in support of what we were doing, and therefore we were building this base behind us that made it impossible for the New York Police Department to do anything but meet our demands when we arrived in the city, because we had thousands of people that had been supporting us on this march. We had a month worth of propaganda campaign behind us.
We are speaking with community activist Simon Sanchez from Austin, Texas. You were talking about some of the negotiating that the marchers on the DNC to RNC march did with the police. I think for some people, the idea of negotiating with the police is alien. It's sort of the police show up, they tell you what to do, and you do it. Can you talk about what the process was of negotiating with the police and how you did it?
Well, basically, we took we never took no for an answer along the whole march, and just took a very firm stance with the police. And all negotiations were done, had a team of a legal observer, video camera, basically a cop watcher, and then a comms person communicating everything that was going on in the negotiations back to the rest of the march, and then the negotiator. And that level of organization for the negotiation team was very intimidating for the police in general. Video cameras are always effective, but just for them to see that we have a team rolling up directly to them, especially when we hit the state of New York, because we had no permit for the state of New York. So as soon as the first cop rolled up on us, we just walked straight up to them and be like, hey, how's it going? This is what we're doing. This is who we are. What can we do to make things more comfortable for you? What can you do to make things more comfortable for us? As we entered the city, it was kind of funny. We got into the Bronx, and I guess the cops had no idea that we were coming. They had no idea who we were. So we were, like, waving down police cars, and we're like, hey, come here, you know. And they, like, walk up and be like, what? You know, whatever. We're busy, you know. And then finally they put two and two together, and they rolled up and had vans line us up and stuff like that. And that's where the negotiations got really heavy. And, like, the strategy for me personally behind negotiating came from working with indigenous uprisings in southern Mexico, where negotiating isn't really necessarily a giving in or an asking for permission. It's just basically a tit for tat. It's like, okay, we'll walk on the sidewalk this far, but then you have to let us walk on the street at this point. We'll commit to nonviolence, but you have to keep those vans and riot cops far away from us. You know, we'll not have sticks, but you can't have sticks. Those types of things. You know, it's just, you know, keeping that balance going. And that's basically what we did to enter the city. And it worked out really well. I mean, I was fairly impressed with Deputy Chief Monahan and how he came through with basically everything we asked for.
How did the police respond to the idea of you making demands on them? I think you were talking about the balance, keeping the balance, and I think that they're very used to having the balance tipped entirely in their favor.
Well, for us in particular, the DNC to RNC march, we had the advantage. We had them, you know. We had a month worth of propaganda behind us. We had thousands of communities behind us. They knew that. And then the fact that we went through these communities and the Secret Service and the FBI swept through them and told them we were coming to terrorize their communities, and then we came through and, like, fixed up gardens for them instead. You know, it's like the people themselves and the media were on our side. There's this one quote from a Boston newspaper that they're interviewing one of the march organizers, and she tells them, yeah, we're going house to house, and we're meeting women, men, and children, and people are telling us, wow, I might be an anarchist too. And that's the way the article ended. You know, like, that's the type of media that we were getting the whole way. We never got a bad soundbite, and it was incredible. And then the police too, like, all along the way, the police were just sending in good reports. So when we got into the city, we're like, go ahead, call these communities, call these police, check on our track record. This is what we've been doing, and this is what we intend on continuing to do.
What do you think it was about the march that made it so well received by the communities that you were going through? We've heard a lot in the New York press about anarchists coming to terrorize the city. The New York Post has been fear-mongering. And I think that people have, that sort of dissent and violence have really become conflated in the popular imagination. Yep.
I think it was two things. One was just the fact that we were walking 258 miles blew everybody away. They just couldn't believe it. And the second that people heard that, it just really struck them. You know, they wanted to give us water. They wanted to give us food. They wanted to give us housing. And the other was just the mainstream media was on our side. We became like the fuzzy protesters, you know, and we were all cuddly and cute. And the people believed that. And then when they saw us, it was true. So it was very easy. Those are the two things I think that contributed to it. And of course, just the organizing along the route was, didn't just get put together. It was 9 months of individuals way other than myself putting this together, going from community to community, talking to city councils, talking to the police, talking to community members, and, like, raising awareness as to what we were intending on doing.
You mentioned earlier about the deployments that you did when you would go to a town. Can you talk a little bit about what you would do when you got to a given town? You weren't just walking from Boston to New York.
Well, for example, we walked into Providence, Rhode Island, and if you know anything about Rhode Island, it's probably the most corrupt state in the nation with the most corrupt capital. I think they've had like two or three mayors go to prison. It's ridiculous. And the hood there is really, really, really rough. I've never seen such rough gentrification and just like broken windows out of hand type of situation. So we went into that community and one, did a community gardening project where we cleaned out a lot. And then two, worked with a youth advocacy program for youth of color called Broad Street Studio. And Broad Street Studio is run by people of color, for people of color, and they basically recover youth coming out of the prison system and do media workshops with them and empower them to like voice their rage uncensored through these media workshops. And Broad Street Studio is umbrellaed by a 501c3 of white anarchists called AS220. So that basic model of like white anarchists figuring out ways to empower the communities to empower themselves, you know, and not creating those codependencies that you normally see going on, that is an issue that I think we're dealing in all of our communities. That was really impressive. That was my favorite space to be in, was Broad Street Studio. That's like the type of stuff that we did along the way as much as humanly possible.
What was the worst moment of the march? Was there a point where you were just thinking, like, oh, man?
There was definitely some provocation in the march that was a destabilizing factor in, like, a very COINTELPRO type kind of way. And about 48 hours before we entered the city, we had a complete mutiny when we were going to be doing a very militant action. And fortunately, we were able to stabilize and get it all together in 48 hours. That was the scariest moment, was like realizing that somebody had planted seeds in people's heads. At one point, people were saying, hey, these Latino organizers that have written our arrival action are part of the Spanish Liberation Army, and they're trying to lead us into an insurrection in the city and all this stuff that sounds whack. But unfortunately, new marchers were starting to believe it, and it was really scary. So recovering from that was definitely the scariest feeling. And then as police liaison, I got chosen to spokes for the march. I had also written the arrival action, and there was a lot of controversy about it since we were going to be masking up and breaking several laws, and people were really scared. So when I woke up the morning of the 26th, I realized that I had 80 people's lives on my hands, and that was pretty scary.
And how was that ultimately resolved?
Oh, it was awesome. The negotiations went through, and the marchers like saw that like we were not giving in, that we were not like negotiating away our commitment to what we intended on doing. That the negotiations were firm, and we stood firm along the way. And as everything that we negotiated along the way, beginning in the Bronx the night before, throughout the day, as the marchers saw that process going on, they were just smiling bigger and bigger and becoming more and more confident that we had created a propaganda machine that was unstoppable. And indeed it was.
I think it's important for people to remember that we have a lot of power, and we do not necessarily have to do what the police want you to.
Absolutely not. I mean, when we got into the Bronx, they asked us, they were like, straight up, you don't have a permit. And I said, well, we have a 250-mile permit, and I don't think you can keep us from making these last 8 miles. And they agreed. They were like, yeah, no. You know, there's nothing we can do about that. And it worked out.
So if people want to find out more about what you guys have done and what you guys might do in the future, where can they find that out?
DNC2RNC.org, 2 as in number 2, DNC2RNC.org. And there's a bunch of video up there. It's pretty cool.
We have been speaking with community activist Simon Sanchez from Austin, Texas, who was on the DNC to RNC march. They marched 258 miles from Boston to New York City from the Democratic National Convention to the Republican National Convention. Thanks for being here with us.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the A-Noise Daily Roundup covering the protests at the Republican National Convention. Today's roundup was produced by Christina Heatherton, Kat Aaron, Tariq Karula, Chris Burnett, and Lee Azzarello. Tune in to anoise.org all this week for breaking news from the streets. Keep it locked.